You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Peter Mishler. Peter, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thank you, Brainerd. Thanks a lot.
Peter, what are you working on now? I know you're going to read a little bit today, a few poems, but and then I have a book of your work, but should we talk about what you're working on now? Is there a manuscript or something in particular you're involved
sure.
in that?
Yeah, so this book, so my first book came out last month, and the book was, you know, I accepted the contract for the book a couple of years ago, and then I mostly worked on revising this book, Flood, for most of that 2 years, and I only wrote one new poem during that time, but then I ended up being able to get that poem into the book before it was published. And so I'm just now, just in the last couple of months, starting new poems for what I would hope would be a new manuscript of poems, because it really took that long, that like about 2 years to find a new way to write lines of poetry that felt the way that I wanted new poems to feel. I was really resistant to them. I think probably more visually looking like the poems that are in this book. And I've just had like this abhorrence to things that looked that way. And I just, you know, had this anxiety about wanting to make them look different. And I finally feel now like I'm writing lines that, and writing a couple of poems that I feel like are working in the way that I wanted them to work. And so, so I've written a couple of new poems toward a manuscript, and I have a bunch of drafts and things floating around and snippets of reading on my desk and things that I want to do. And, you know, it's like I have some ideas in mind for things I want to explore, although I have to keep my mind open that I'll probably ignore 90% of those things and move on to other things, because I tend to be kind of I lack a little bit of disorder or coherence in that way. But regardless, the most important thing is that I'm writing new poems. And for me, that was something that I was, I guess I knew I probably would end up writing new ones, but I was, of course, worried that somehow I wouldn't, you know. And now that I am, I feel like I'll continue to. So it's kind of a nice place to be in.
Life goes on after the completion of a book? The fear that after you finish the book that there will be no more poems? Is that kind
yeah.
of
yeah? I think it's like, for me, it's like this. It's writing the book Flood. I didn't really understand the book or really know what I was getting at until after I had finished it and started to think about ways to talk about it. I knew at a, you know, an interior and intuitive level that the book was finished and that it was something that I wanted to say. But stepping back from it to be able to talk about it, you know, then you start to realize, I started to realize what it was really doing or some of the things it might have been saying. And so having that mystery occur and have that be such a powerful experience for me to go from unknowing to a kind of knowing, you know, it's like when I started trying to write new poems after having written Flood, I was constantly wondering, oh, I wonder what puzzle piece this will be in the greater puzzle of a larger manuscript, and started to overthink the intentions of the poems as I was writing them, you know, kind of after having this knowledge that, you know, there's going to be something bigger that I can't understand yet. You know, it's like, I want it now, and I want to see. And so that was frustrating me, because I'd really prefer to be in a place where I'm moving through my writing intuitively and with a sense of form and music and the metrics of the poem, and just being overwhelmed by it at a more, like I said, a more like interior intuitive place, and to be sort of more self-conscious about what that might bring about has really frustrated me for a while. But now I've been finding some ways to sort of fool myself into getting back to a more, you know, a clean slate, I guess would be the way to put it.
Well, the book seems like a great success, and you know, the other layer in it, you're talking about these layers, is also, of course, the reaction, and you know, you won a few prizes, right? The Catherine A.
Right.
Morton Prize in Poetry,
yeah.
And so besides how you built this, also in reflecting on it, there's also taking in, wow, other people seem to have liked this too, which is something that you don't know beforehand. It must change the meaning of it in some way. It means it's working, doesn't it also?
I think so, especially because it's a first book, and I think first books probably take the longest to write because there's nothing that comes before it. So I could technically say I've been working on it since I first started writing poems. And I think along the way, I've definitely had the journey. I've been on a journey toward a state of confidence in my work, and having it acknowledged by an outside party was certainly a great boon there as well. Mm-hmm. And so to answer your question, yeah, I think that having it be acknowledged, and especially reading the introduction to the book that the poet wrote about it, I started to think, okay, there's something being said here, and I wonder if my conscious thinking also aligns with what is being said in this introduction and being said by the book. And then I started to sort of formulate some opinions about the book.
The introduction was by Dean Young, correct?
Yes. And he's a poet that I've a poet that I admire, although I would say also he's a poet I purposely not read very much of, because I knew his work would be really seductive for me in a way that I would tend to want to avoid, and trying to kind of carve out a somewhat original path for myself. Although of course I was really, I was really pleased that he picked the book. And I also sent the book with, knowing that he might be interested in it, because I think we have some things in common, and it turns out we do. And based on how he wrote about my book, and I really think, I don't want to say like I found myself aligned with him in some way, but his acknowledgement of the book really made me start to think that I had something of value to say. And I think that's a one-time experience. I don't think writing a second book will be that same way for me, because I have a different level of confidence now in my work that wasn't there when I first started writing poems. And so now I feel like I'm in a place where I can say a lot about my work, and that's to the detriment maybe of new work sometimes. And so, I'm always trying to find a balance between knowing and unknowing what I'm doing.
So let's hear a little bit about what you're doing. I'd love to hear a few poems from Flood, or if you want to read from whatever's on your desk. But Flood, of course, has a special context too.
I think I'll read the poem that was the first poem I wrote for Flood. I'm really itching to read my new work to you, although I want to send it out first to some journals before I share it. But I do want to let you know that I really am excited about what I'm writing now. But I'll read Flood to you, the title poem of the book, because it was the first poem I wrote for the book. And it is also the poem where I first started to feel like I was communicating something at a level kind of underneath my typical kind of rational or logical understanding of things. And so the poem felt like something to me, even if I didn't know what it was doing. And so the poem's called Flood, and I'll read that one to you. Flood. The light had its gradient pull. I scanned away from the schoolyard with the lens sparkling, and the moon divvied up into separate grains. I find the coin I'd skimmed from the lake, and when it cries, I'm reminded the lead ocean itself is waiting with love within us. None of us dared trim away the snake skin that summer for fear of what was beneath its unwinding. Beyond us, all of our glassware is being sewn over in a future where a shoulder blade is found and dug up again. It will know nothing of us or the ocean that crept through the sun. Difficult child, shrilling lake unhinged. You stand in a state of mild yawning in a church of your own gold, peeling your shadow from the diving board. On stage, it was said, file in. The sounds of undressing and song coursed through the back halls and were lost behind the beverage machines. We were placed in line as if meant to return our crossbows, and I loved these cross purposes. At night, in our beds, our legs snapped like dawn on a hinterland of ice. We were told God was winnowing us into fascinating lutes while the flood ranged southward.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you. Yeah.
So exciting. I mean, so much, interesting kind of imagery in there, and also a story that leaves there's a lot of mystery, right? There's a lot of room in there to move into it.
I think so. Yeah, and I think that was what, you know, looking at the poem on the page, having written it, that's what really felt to me. I think that's the best word for it. The poem felt, and I didn't know what to do with it except for that I knew that I really cherished it, and I felt like I was able to get past a place of writing poems of narrative exposition or of you know, like kind of a dramatic narrative that unfolds from beginning, middle to end with an arc to it. Sort of the way I was maybe taught to write poems, or the way that I thought poems were meant to be written. And then I wrote this and I thought, okay, well, this is capturing my experience at a level that's either above or underneath or deeper than what I could, you know, detail writing my lived experience in some chronology or narrative. And so in that regard, it felt much richer for me and much more powerful.
Well, it's a kind of freedom too that you gave yourself that's beyond, it sounds like, the structures that you've had, which it's easy, I would think. I mean, I don't know, not a poet myself, but I would think it would tend towards giving yourself a structure as opposed to kind of inventing it.
Right. And I think knowing that there was that freedom opened me up in so many different ways to trust myself to make lines of poetry that were going to feel for me, and not necessarily have to be committed to sense. And that doesn't mean that I wrote nonsense. Well, in some cases I did, I guess, but that doesn't mean that I wrote, you know, with all, you know, throwing all care to the wind without any careful study of, you know, the poets I've loved or the careful study of music or the music of poetry. But it allowed me to see that there are things beyond my own experience that still are my experience. And they may not be my lived experience of reality in, you know, chronological order, but they are me and they are a part of my life. Maybe not my conscious waking life, but they're a part of my life. And I feel to value that and to privilege that in my work is to feel more like the person that I really am, which is that I have a dream life and I have a unconscious life and an associative life that's outside of, you know, what I'm doing day to day.
Let's hear another one from Flood. It's so good to hear that, and I'd love to hear a few more, but what will you read us next? And should we talk at all about Blake's Songs of Innocence? Or?
Yeah, we could do that. I would love to do that. Why don't I read a poem that's directly influenced by Blake?
Okay.
In the sense that this poem takes one of the characters from Songs of Innocence and Experience, and, you know, kind of further imagines his story. And so it's the last poem in the book, and it's called Little Tom Dacre in Heaven. And Little Tom Dacre is one of the characters in William Blake's poem, The Chimney Sweeper. And in that poem, the speaker, who's a chimney sweep, a young child who's, you know, sold by his family into exploitative child labor, he's there with Tom Dacre, and Tom Dacre is terrified and sad and scared of this job that he's going to have to do, which is to be, you know, pressed into a tiny chimney. And they're trying to console Tom. The other child, the one child, the chimney sweeper, is trying to console Tom. And Tom ends up having this dream where he's freed from this labor and kind of deposited gently into a beautiful heaven. But then, of course, they wake up and they go back to work. And so the poem is grim and satirical and, you know, kind of damning and crushing, you know, crushing the spirits
of
these children.
An angel kind of helps him, right?
Yeah, the angel comes with a bright key and unlocks their coffins, and then they go out into this kind of this field, like a kind of pastoral field, to run around.
It's
like,
beautiful, really. Like, it's a beautiful idea.
It is. And then the end of the poem is just so incredibly crushing. They wake up in the dark, and they get back, and they get their brushes and get ready, and they go back to work. And the last lines of the poem are something along the I don't want to misquote it, but something along the lines of, like, so if we all do our our duty, we need not fear harm, meaning, you know, we just need to get back to work and just keep kind of, trucking along and have some sort of, concede to this life that we're living. And of course, that's said with a wink and a nod from Blake, knowing that the reader is not going to be able to accept that kind of fate for these children. And so I decided to write about little Tom Dacre actually ending up in heaven, in an afterlife or paradise, and looking down on our world now and seeing it. And I mean, it's not like it's a direct, it's not like it has many direct references to the poem. I think it's more adopting him as a figure who has been harmed by the world, who's now beyond it and is able to look back on it and sort of see it for what it's worth. And so it's corresponding with Blake in the sense of adopting that child's position of innocence and talking about what he sees and maybe giving him a sense of freedom in some way. So I'll read that one for you if that's okay.
I'd love that.
All right. Yeah, thank you. Okay, so little Tom Dacre in heaven. And through my tears in the hereafter, I see my tears received below, on the arched back of a chief of staff, dragging his skiff behind him and wandering the incorporated limits in his suit the color of underground lakes. Lo, to feel as indifferent now as the candy dispenser, the unlit carport, the blue flag sunk in front of my old elementary school. But here, too, I can touch my heart to a knotted tree, and its murmuring can be heard in the leaves of an office plant misted down on earth by a man committing lines of love to memory in his green security jacket. Child I was who once sought guidance at the whirlpool, the colored milk still in my bowl, who was lifted for inspection by command, and when I was held in the doctor's arms, his ears were warm with blood, and I shielded my mouth with a tear-shaped mint, a spell to halt the interrogating lamp as he spun it toward my face. It was well covering time. We children were served our salad greens in centurion's helmets, never to be worn again. And the widow Bilgewater was ticking down our names while we gathered and carried the covering sticks, her eyes as blank as the backside of the Board of Health and the dark pools of rain that gathered there. And in them, I saw the sleepers covering the hills with their bodies, a whalebone wrested from the tabernacle by thieves, a furniture outlet looted clean, a woodsman glancing over his shoulder as he bit into a greasy heart, the piles of ash in the wilderness, the stinking ligatures on the helmsman's neck, a sea full of in-flight magazines, a band of actuaries discarding their ties to bark at the brown water stain of the moon, until the mesh hood was pulled down over my naked head, and I woke up here.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Also a dark ending.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was really, really lovely. I want you to read one more, but just talk a little bit about that. That, of course, was more narrative than the first poem. I mean, similar kind of beautiful imagery,
right.
It was great that we talked a little bit about Blake before that, but
yeah. I think, you know, using Blake as a model, you can't help but maybe go a little bit more narrative. And, you know, sometimes you work on something and it ends up having that narrative arc and you just keep it, you know. And so in that case, that worked. Now here's one that I'll read one more poem that doesn't have that. Well, actually, no, this one does have a kind of clear narrative position, although making the poem didn't feel that way at all, although all of a sudden it kind of came together. And this one has a character of a boatsman, and the boatsman is appears throughout the book because, you know, the book takes place at least in part in a flooded world, and so there's this boatsman Noah-like figure who appears throughout, but he's generally in the book a menacing figure as opposed to a figure who's able to save the animals and everything else like Noah is in Genesis. And so this is sort of a more ominous boatsman character. And this poem's called Head in the Orchard. Head in the Orchard. Why the boatsman spared me, I do not know. He stood above me on the overpass without a word, his eyes downcast and clear, his wreath of sawgrass hung around his neck. This in the time of the orchard full of fruit. I looked at him, a worm within my feasting, squinting through the scouring light. And while we did not break our stares, my blind hand shook behind me as I searched my satchel for the axe. I freed its knot, smelled the out-breath of the sap and sunlight on the blade within, then cinched the cord again, that scent now wasted on the world. I spared him, too. Half my life I'd spent sleeping in the sun, the other under the orchard starlight, the roseate sun to seek. Here is the tree to which I nailed my head, and northward the flattened field where I loosed my dogs, my body borne behind them, making tracks. The boatsman could not read atop his ledge, although I know he did look down at me once more, his forehead softened, hair salt damp, his bone-white cape whipping downwind.
Lovely. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And so, yeah, before I ask you the last question, to talk a little bit about that poem, and these are all from Flood, of course, the book that there's a link to in this interview. What about that in the context of Blake and this book?
Oh, could you say that again? I'm sorry.
What about in terms of Blake and in this book? That poem occupies its own sort of position.
Yes, and. You know that when I wrote the poem Flood, I titled the poem Flood because I thought the poem, you know, I was talking about looking at the poem and thinking about what it meant or what it was saying to me, and it reminded me of being performing in the play Noah's Flood, which is spelled that same way, N-O-Y-E, apostrophe as F-L-U-D-D-E, and which is the way that Benjamin Britten chose to spell the name of the opera that he wrote based on. The Middle English spelling of Noah's Flood. And I had performed in that play when I was a boy, and I was wondering whether that poem Flood was speaking to that experience. And then, of course, I started thinking about flood stories, and I started thinking about my experience of performing in that play and being such a young child, kind of taking in all of this apocalyptic information. And I started to sort of riff on that in different ways, you know, because the flood story is so rich ecologically, you know, there's so many flood stories, you know, anthropologically, the story holds a very powerful seat. Thinking about the power dynamics of the people and the animals, you know, the patriarchal figure, the boatsman in my case, and just starting to play around with those images or those figures or subjects or those dynamics and generating poems out of that. And so the book is largely populated by different versions of flood stories or the ways in which those flood stories could occur now or rewriting the Noah's Flood story, and just sort of, thinking about a world before a flood, after a flood, during a flood. And those are just things I was able to play with and write lines and just kind of see where it went. So that's, I think that Head in the Orchard poem is related to that.
Well, thank you, Peter. And before we go, I want to ask you the question I ask everyone, what are you reading at the moment? I'm always curious.
Sure. Yeah. So I like to read a lot at once and then kind of let it collide with each other. And so I have a lot going at once, depending on right now I'm off from school, so I can read, you know, I can have a morning reading time and an afternoon reading time and a night reading time. And and so my morning reading today was primarily, I was reading in the King James version of the book of Ezekiel this morning. And I was looking at Keats's poem Endymion a little bit, and was interested in those two figures, Ezekiel and Endymion. In the afternoon today, I didn't read in the afternoon today, actually. And this evening I have two books. I'm reading for the first time Kafka's The Castle in the older translate, the mirror translation of it. It's a little older for the first time, and really fascinated by that. And then also a book that is it's a Yale University Press book. It's called Seeing in the Dark. It's Reflections on Dreams and Dreaming, which is right up my alley in terms of the study of the theories of dreams. It's a really, really fascinating book. And so just kind of dipping into these different interests of mine and seeing if they end up yielding new poems.
Well, thank you so much, Peter. It's really been a pleasure talking to you today and hearing your work. And
Likewise.
I hope everybody checks out the book. And I wish you great success with this one and the next one. Thank you so much, Peter.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.